Oh, I got a pig. Did I tell you that?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Finally, you were waiting for one, right?
Yeah. And then it came. We got the call.
That's exciting.
So it's from Nature's Green Acres, the Rizikas in Viking, Alberta, and I was processed in Tofield, and I picked it up, and now I've got a veritable butcher shop in my freezer shell.
What state was it in when you picked it up?
Insides.
Primals or a side?
Insides,
two sides?
Yeah.
Crazy. Sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, actually, I had it in my head that I could process a pig, like fully process and pack a pig in 3 hours. Mm. But then I started working and I was like, oh no, that was just one side. It definitely takes 6 or 7 hours right. to do all this. Yeah.
But now it's all done.
Yeah. All that's left to do is my kids love soup. And so I made a really big batch of...
Maybe I'm your kid.
So I know that you're supposed to keep bones on the roast because it makes it taste better and everything, but I bone out absolutely everything except for the ribs. Everything okay. else, the bones get taken off and roasted. And I think I ended up with about 16 liters of stock, and I need to can that still because I don't have room in
right.
the freezer. So tomorrow morning, I'm going to bring out the pressure canner and put up some
can all your stock.
Yeah.
And did you make a batch of soup yet? Or
no. No. But maybe this weekend we can. The one tricky thing is, like, one of Cora's favorite things to eat, bar none, is chicken noodle soup. But now I've got to sell her on pork noodle soup or or I don't know, put quotation marks around the chicken or whatever. I think it'll be fine, but it tastes a little different.
Yeah, it does taste a little different. I wonder, you know, like, because the content is a lot of what makes chicken noodle soup good, like, or the inclusions, you know? Mm-hmm. So, might be fine. Might taste a little different, but she might still be into it.
Like, to me, I mean, she's never said this, but to me, what's so nourishing and delicious about the soup is, like, it's the gelatin, like, the body of the broth, and if it's seasoned well. And there's noodles in it.
And there's noodles. Yeah, exactly. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and thankfully I'm back here with my good pal, Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
Great.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it.
Welcome back.
Thanks, Alan. I'm back, baby.
Are you okay?
I'm mostly okay. So yeah, I had COVID for the first time, which knocked me on my butt pretty badly, actually. Mm-hmm. I kind of had in the back of my head, because I was double vaccinated and then extra vaccinated,
right.
that and I'd heard a lot of anecdotal stories about people who were vaccinated not being as affected by it the first time that they caught COVID.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was pretty rough. It was like 4 days where I couldn't really do anything.
Right.
Couldn't really get out of bed much.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just seemed like it had such a really long tail. Like, I was feeling better. I kind of had my energy back, but I was still coughing a lot and had a head cold, and that seemed to drag on for like more than a week before I was able to go back to work. And even now, I'm sure maybe astute listeners can hear that my voice is maybe a little hoarser than usual or something like that, but I'm feeling pretty good now. I have all my energy back, and generally my head's cleared up and my chest is mostly cleared up, and I'm feeling quite good now. But
yeah, awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty rough. And I think, like, the timing of when we recorded last time sort of worked out well, or when you recorded.
Right.
Because I was just sort of starting to feel a little bit better on the day that you recorded, and then I was able to edit the episode and get it out. But thanks for doing that, Alan. Thanks for covering my butt.
Oh, no problem.
A little peek behind the curtain is, I think, like, normally, back me up on this, Alan, if you if you feel like it's accurate. But like normally, I think we kind of like to have a contingency, like an extra episode recorded that maybe isn't necessarily, doesn't have to be timely or has like subject matter that's evergreen or something, so that if one of us gets sick and it's just really not possible for us to record, that we have something in our back pocket to post as an episode. But we didn't have that this time,
because I think we've only actually done that once, right, where we posted episode from the can. We should see.
And then luckily we only had to cover our butts once, but I guess then this past time was the time that we had to cover our butts and didn't have something. So
I wonder if anyone could guess which episode it was.
I'd be curious to find out.
There's a prize. I'll buy you an ice cream cake if you can guess which one.
Yeah, totally. I think I can't remember. I can't even remember right off the top of my head which episode it was. And so I
remember.
Can't comment on how hard I think it'll be to determine. But I'm sure it's pretty obvious if you went back and listened to a little bit of each one.
But speaking of the last,
it's probably the only episode where we don't say sorry. Sorry to interrupt you, Alan. But it's probably like the only episode where we don't say we talked about this last time,
right,
or
yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
What do you have any? What was your impression of the last recording?
I mean, my first and very most important impression was that you're a hero for rescuing us. Thank you for doing an episode on your own. I don't know if I would have felt comfortable just sitting down with like some notes and delivering a monologue. And I think you really pulled it off.
I've kind of thought about this listening to our conversations in the past, but I really thought about it a lot after doing that. I say so much. It's crazy. Yeah. How do I stop that?
I don't know, therapy. And I'm bad at it too. And so if I had some advice, I would certainly hand it off here. Maybe we need to talk to a vocal coach or something like that, come up with some better strategies for how not to say all the time. But yeah, I'm really horrible at it.
I think like electroshock therapy, like something...
Like yeah, you set it up so
you get
collar.
Zapped every time you say but holy cow. Mm-hmm. And I listen to other
podcasts. It's
like
a shock collar, and Siri listens to you while you're talking, and every time you say you get a little shock.
Yeah, I think that would work quick.
I do take a lot of them out often when I'm
really?
Editing.
Yeah.
Not all of them, definitely. Oh, I know this is, it's going to be impossible for us to have a conversation now because
yeah, exactly.
Every time either one of us says now, we're just going to laugh our butts off.
Yeah.
But I do make an effort to take some of the ones that sound like really redundant out. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you're thinking about something while you're talking and you're using that as a tool to sort of give yourself the time to collect your thought before you say the sentence that you're going to say or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it sounds really redundant, or sometimes there's like an or an ah and a really long break. Oh, I'm sure this is fascinating for all the listeners. And
this is a new low.
And so in cases like that where there's like a really long break and an or something like that, I'll just like clip it out. And I have a way of editing that makes that relatively easy. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I do a little bit of that cleanup. And if you've ever been listening to the podcast and it sounds like someone starts talking in the middle of taking a breath, it's usually because I try to sort of cover those over. But in some instances, I'm just like, it's not that noticeable. And I just let it go. So, but it bugs me every time. Every time I'm listening to the podcast, I'm like, oh, geez, that's really rough.
So what about, do you have specific feedback? I think I had a lot of open-ended, like, this can't be true, can it?
Yeah, and when you have nobody to bounce it off of, and you know, like there's nobody there to just bullshit and pretend to back you up or whatever.
Right.
Well, yeah, while I was listening and editing, I made some notes. Are you excited to hear what I had to say, Alan? Actually, you've probably seen it all. I think I put it all in our Slack. So, but there are definitely a few things that I heard you talking about where I was like, I have something to say about this. And then, of course, in the moment, I was totally... it like crossed my mind to consider like recording some responses and just like slotting them into the edit.
Like live streaming, or sorry, like live commentary on...
Yeah, like when a producer breaks in on a radio show or something and says, actually, we have this piece of information, or actually, we have a caller on the line, or something like that. Okay, so what are they? Follow up from Alan's very brave episode about accidental recipes. Is that what we called it?
I think so, yeah. Or accident, yeah.
Yeah. Dishes that people came up with by making mistakes. So you were talking about beurre blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't exactly remember what you said that sort of triggered this for me, but I think it was like that, that it's hard to accidentally make beurre blanc because you have to stir the butter into, so you start with a reduction, a gastrique is usually what it is like the base of a traditional beurre blanc sauce, right?
Not, gastrique usually would start with caramelized sugar and beurre blanc wouldn't. I would just say it's like a reduction of the wine, vinegar, and shallot.
Right, that's fair. I guess I have a broader definition of gastrique maybe, but yeah, you're right, for sure. Historically and traditionally. But yeah, so you have a reduction of wine and seasonings and shallot and usually some black pepper or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, black peppercorns, because you definitely don't want flecks of pepper in your beurre blanc, Alan. That would be
not very blanc of you.
Completely unacceptable. Totally acceptable for me. So yeah, and you were saying that you feel like it's hard to make that sauce by accident because it requires emulsifying the butter actively, as like you're keeping the sauce hot on the stove and then you're stirring in the butter in order to keep it emulsified while you're adding it to the sauce, and that's what gives the sauce its like thickness and richness, is that the butter is still emulsified in it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was going to say about that is that I actually have seen people, and I haven't really tried to do this myself on purpose, but I've seen people make beurre blanc by taking whatever liquid they're going to use as the base of the sauce and taking all of the butter, usually cubed already. So that is a bit of a non-accidental step, I guess, maybe, or something. Mm-hmm. But I guess if you were going to, I mean, what would you be making where you would cube up all the butter ahead of time? Probably nothing besides a beurre blanc. Maybe in certain cases, if you were going to make a béarnaise or a hollandaise. Oh, right. And that's the idea, is that somebody was trying to make one of those types of sauces, right?
Yeah, someone was trying to make béarnaise, and I said it's unlikely that they would accidentally make beurre blanc, because for beurre blanc, you need to start with cold butter, and béarnaise, you usually start with melted butter.
That was the distinction. And also the egg situation. But I guess the accident is that they forgot to add the egg, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I have seen people make beurre blanc by adding all of their butter to the liquid all at once and then boiling it hard. And then at some point, and to be fair, they did start with cold cubed butter. They didn't start with melted butter. But I don't really see why there would be much of a difference in this regard in terms of how this technique works. But basically, you have the liquid boiling on the stove. You add all of the butter at once. The butter then melts in the liquid and then starts to boil on the stove. And then there's a certain point where at which because the boiling is providing pretty vigorous movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because of, if you've ever been making a big batch of beurre blanc, like, you know that sometimes it's necessary to adjust the amount of liquid that's in there, because if you're making it for a really long time, the liquid is evaporating as you're making it. And depending on how much of the reduction you start with, eventually you can wind up, if you have too much evaporation before you mix in all of the butter that you need to mix in, the sauce can break because it needs to have a certain amount of liquid in it in order to stay emulsified.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a point at which, if you're just boiling melted butter and liquid together, there's a point at which the liquid becomes sort of like the exact right amount to emulsify the amount of fat that's in the sauce. And the boiling liquid provides enough stirring that it emulsifies. I don't think it's like, it's probably not as strong an emulsion, and it's probably not as stable as if you are stirring, if you're whisking in cold butter in the traditional way, mm-hmm. like that probably creates a more stable emulsion because it's, you're stirring it more vigorously. But yeah, I've definitely seen people make a butter sauce that way. Just boil a bunch of butter in liquid until it emulsifies and then take it off the stove. Boom.
That isn't that. Is that real? Is that real? You've actually
That's
seen
real. It? Yeah. Yeah. I've seen people do it.
And so you're saying that like, so
also, that's in a way, I know it's kind of different, but in a way, that's what's happening when you monte a sauce with butter, like a pan sauce. Mm-hmm. You are also usually stirring in that situation, mm-hmm. and you're trying to do a similar thing to what you do with a beurre blanc. You're usually adding cold butter and stirring it in vigorously. But it's also like if you're like fortifying like a pasta sauce or something like that, and you have like pasta water in the bottom of the pan,
yeah.
and you add cold butter to it, like it's partially the like boiling of the sauce that's already in the pan or the pasta water or whatever. And then in the case of pasta water, there's like a little bit of additional starch there that helps with that process. Mm-hmm. But you can make like an emulsified sauce with butter and pasta water just by boiling it. And it's sort of the same situation in this case.
But so like with the Monte au beurre and the Montecato, adding butter to the pan for pasta, mm-hmm. it's still cold butter. And that's, to me, that's the yeah. whole point, is that it's like, because it's cold, the importance of the butter being cold is that the liquefied butter gets added very slowly to the total mm-hmm. mix, because it's like only the very exterior melting and you're agitating it to kind of shear it off.
Yeah, so like, the same way that you would like slowly drip oil into a dressing that you're trying to emulsify.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I totally agree, and that totally makes sense. But yeah, I've seen people boil a beurre blanc into existence before. So
you're saying like if I just take a pound of butter and melt it in a pan and bring it to a boil, like to make brown butter or something, mm-hmm. that doesn't emulsify because it doesn't have enough liquid? Doesn't re-emulsify because it doesn't have enough liquid?
That's right.
Shale, I'm gonna investigate this because it's
yeah definitely
because it's so counter classic that I
know totally it totally goes against the prevailing wisdom. Mm-hmm. And the first time someone told me about this phenomenon, I was very skeptical. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why then? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know what I'm like. I'm like, why then would they teach us that we have to slowly emulsify in all of the butter, like, you know, from cold? Mm-hmm. In school, if you can do the same thing just by boiling everything together.
The way that I'm feeling inside right now reminds me of when I watched Heston Blumenthal make risotto without stirring it and just like
stirring
putting the lid on it
yeah.
and boiling it. And I was like, not only skeptical, but also like, oh, what a hack. But obviously like if it yeah. works, it works. And it's not, yeah, I don't know. Okay, I'm going
to... Yeah, well, and I'm not saying that this is how I would choose to make a beurre blanc. What I'm saying is I feel like the fact that this does work as like as a technique to make a sauce just adds fuel to the fire of the idea that someone could do it by accident.
Oh, I see.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
if you took all of your melted butter yeah. and if you had all your melted butter and you added it to your... the base of your sauce and you didn't have any egg in there, mm-hmm. and then you were just like, oh man, I really messed up this sauce, but then you boiled it for a while and it came together, you'd be like, well, I guess I made something else, you know, like
right, okay, yeah,
you know, like there is this like this technique that I've seen done that lends itself to the idea that someone could potentially make this sauce by accident.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm not trying to say that everyone should make their beurre blanc by boiling a bunch of liquid and butter together. What I am trying to say is that I think it is potentially possible that someone discovered this by accident. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I am going to go boil some butter and report back to you next
Do it, week. I promise. I mean, it's similar, like I don't know if there are a lot of people out there making drawn butter this way. Mm-hmm. And I think in most cases, people are making drawn butter using pretty much the like cold butter, whisking in cold butter technique. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, for drawn butter, it's a similar situation. Like if you start with a little bit of water in your pan and add a bunch of cold butter and just let it boil, at some point it'll come together. You got to watch it the whole time because at, you know, like it's only together for like, 10 or so seconds before the ratio changes and then it splits again. But
okay.
The larger amount that you have, probably the larger window you have where the amount is correct, but.
Okay, I'm going to test it.
Okay, I'm excited to hear back.
Anything else?
So that was thing one. And then thing two is that you can...
Great Dr. Seuss reference there. Thank you. Sorry, no one's going to get that, are they?
Sure they will.
From the Cat in the Hat?
Everybody knows about thing one, thing two.
Okay, sorry.
Then the other thing is that you can... There are like certain types of... sauces which are similar to béarnaise where, like, for instance, in the French Laundry cookbook there's a lemon tart. It's a lemon sabayon tart with pine nut crust, I believe. I worked in a kitchen where we used the filling from that tart to make one of our desserts. And so I made large batches of that lemon sabayon all the time. And part of it is made basically just how you make like a regular sabayon. But then you add a whole bunch of cold butter at the end. You whisk in a whole bunch of cold butter at the end. And that helps the sabayon set up when it cools. Because you have all of this butter emulsified into it. And there's a ton of egg yolk in that, which helps keep the butter emulsified. But you do add it cold at the end after you've taken the sauce off the heat. I think that's partially to help cool it down so that it'll set up faster when you go to pour the desserts. But but it also is an example of, you know, the fact that you can emulsify cold butter into those types of sauces. And so that's also, you know, a possibility. Maybe for some reason the story got tweaked a little bit, but, you know, maybe they weren't exactly making a béarnaise. Maybe they were making a sauce where they wanted to emulsify the cold butter into it and they had the butter cut up or something. And then sort of the third thing about beurre blanc was kind of a question about that just sort of occurred to me while you were talking about it. And that is, like, there are a lot of sauces that get served in restaurants that are like made a la minute, like pan sauces. It's not the kind of thing where you're making a whole bunch of sauce ahead of time. You're like making it each time you make the dish. And mostly those sauces involve emulsifying some fat into some liquid that you have in the pan for making the dish. So could be meat juices that you have from resting a steak, or could be, I don't know, could be a bunch of stuff. Could be fond and white wine or something like that. And what are those sauces? How do those sauces fit into the five mother sauces? Because they're broadly used, and they also somewhat defy categorization in the same way that beurre blanc does. And so would they be in the same family, do you think? Since a lot of those sauces are made by emulsifying butter, or what do you think about that?
We're talking about pan sauces. Like, we've pan roasted a pork chop and we've got foam in the bottom of the pan and we add a bit of wine and a bit of reduction and then mount it with butter. That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're right. It does defy. I mean, the one that it makes me think of most is like the mother's sauce, like Espanol or demi-glace, because it's based on, it depends what kind of, I'm picturing like using a veal reduction or whatever, but you could obviously use any kind of stock or reduction in it. Yeah. It doesn't fit into any of those.
And like, if you look at the ancient sauce categorization table, like a sauce like Espanol, as you put it, which is not a sauce that anyone makes, but
you have to make sauce, it to make demi.
I mean, yeah, sort of, but I've never made demi that way. Yeah. Like, and generally within the like confines of classically making that sauce, aren't you using a roux for it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which you would never use to make demi glace. like
a modern demi,
not modern demiglass. Yeah. And so, yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, I guess honestly, it seems a little silly to like rely on that.
Yes.
Set of categories to describe modern sauces, you know, like that categorization is like 250 years old and doesn't really apply anymore. There are a lot of sauces that don't really fit into it in the way that, you know.
Yep. It's
if you're learning how to be a saucier in a modern kitchen, you know, you would only really have a peripheral contact with a lot of the sauces that fall easily into those categories.
Yes, it absolutely. Even though it is still 100% taught in culinary school, it is absolutely a vestige of Escoffier and the style of classical cooking that happened in the grand hotels of Europe. And yes, it's not really a boots on the ground modern contemporary professional kitchen approach. Although, yes, I'll just leave it at that.
We don't have to get into the whole discussion of like how the curriculum for cooking school needs to be updated or anything like that. But I think that like it's a pretty, you know, it's like a pretty old way of trying to categorize sauces. It's good as a framework to sort of like give cooks who are just learning the basics to give them a framework to sort of like a structure on which they can kind of like help learn, like that will help them learn some techniques that will give them access to the ability to make a whole bunch of different types of sauces.
Yeah.
Not necessarily applicable in a modern sense to what you might wind up doing in a restaurant, especially like in a fine dining setting or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What else? Oh, when I posted this thing about pan sauces, you said you had a sharp retort, but...
Oh, really?
I guess you forgot what it was.
I was probably just making a joke because I work at a culinary school and I was going to like, you know, die on the hill of Escoffier or something. I don't know.
Oh, Alan. That's so romantic. And then the last sort of thing that, the last sort of like follow-up that I had about, your discussion was you were talking about a type of German pancakes, Kaiserschmarrn.
Austrian, yeah.
Austrian, sorry. My bad. Wherein, do you want to just quickly describe them to us again?
Yeah, it's basically a broken pancake, a mashed up pancake, or a pancake that is like you pour the batter into the pan, it starts to set, but then you start scrambling it like you would eggs until it's all cooked through. You put it on a plate
and then you wind up with sort of like loose kind of pancake curd sort of situation,
like a pancake hash kind of and then you dust it with icing sugar and eat it with jam.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, how could it not be?
You were talking about like that sort of like inspired you to think about, are there other preparations that you can make where you sort of like treat something that's more like pancake batter, more like you would eggs, like making an omelet or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's already like pretty well trodden territory in the Netherlands.
Oh,
like
okay, yeah.
Pannenkoeken, there's like all these different varieties. You can get them with things that are like cooked into them, like an omelet, like a couple different kinds of omelets, but like the type of omelet where you would like start with your inclusions in the pan and then just add the egg and make the omelet in the shape or whatever. And then also they do a lot of stuffing of pancakes. So like rolled up pancakes with things inside them, which is sort of like the other type of omelet.
Right. So I was wondering, and it's, I just need to try it this weekend, I guess, but like if you're doing a pancake as an omelet with inclusions, can you do it as a French omelet where you don't fully flip it and both sides of the omelet touch the pan like an American omelet? Can you do it like that? Or sorry, did that make sense what I just said?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I'm like 90% sure that you can.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you have a pancake in a pan the same way that you would have like the scrambled egg in the bottom of the pan and you cook it until it's not quite set. And then you flip it over and quickly add your inclusions to the hot side. And then while it's still soft enough, you fold it over itself. Yeah. I don't see why not.
So you wouldn't
imagine it not working.
You would need to do the full flip to touch the second side of the pancake to the pan, you think?
I mean, I think so, because probably raw pancake batter, like, if you have a little bit of like softish, like verging on raw egg in your omelet, it's sort of expected.
Yeah.
Like soft egg is expected in your omelet.
Right. But not for pancake, right? Yeah.
Probably not pancake batter. Like
that's the area that I like, the gray area where I'm curious to just try it and see how it plays out. Yeah.
I think that there are probably alterations that you could make to your pancake batter that would make that way more palatable. Mm-hmm. Like maybe if your pancake batter was potentially more eggy and less floury or something like that,
mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that would, you know, there's probably some like experimentation that you could do there where you could have a pancake batter that would still taste good and not taste like floury and inedible if it wasn't completely cooked through,
mm-hmm.
or something. But I think that's sort of the problem there, is that like the uncooked flour,
yeah.
in the pancake batter is not very palatable. Mm-hmm. So I think you'd have to maybe alter your pancake batter recipe a little bit. I wonder, it also kind of got me thinking about these like pancakes that I've seen on TikTok a couple of times.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think they're either like a Japanese or Korean type of like street food or breakfast food or something,
mm-hmm.
but they're like pancakes that are basically a meringue. So I'm sure that is
pancakes, right? Like,
yeah, like just giant souffle pancakes though. Like mm-hmm. they're so huge. Yeah. And I've seen them quite a bit, and I'm assuming that they don't really fully get cooked through all the way. Like,
oh yeah.
I'm imagining that the middles of them must be at least like a little bit jiggly. Otherwise I feel like they would be like really dry.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had one, so I don't actually know, but I feel like, yeah, if you cook them to death, they wouldn't taste very good. And so I wonder what the situation is there. Like if they tend to be a little bit soft in the middle.
That's so funny that you mentioned that. Just yesterday I was driving on Calgary Trail and I saw a business called Fua Fua Japanese pancakes. And I was like, oh, I wonder are those crazy souffle pancakes I saw online. Yeah, just like a block south of White. We should check it out.
Yeah, we should definitely check it out.
And
yeah, so I don't know. That was all the mean things that I had to say about your amazing monologue.
Any comments on the jokes?
They're really bad, Alan. They're really bad.
Thank you.
There was that one joke that was like borderline like
sexist.
I wouldn't say it was borderline sexist. It was definitely sexist, but like it was like borderline acceptable. I feel like.
Right.
The only reason why I hope that it didn't offend anyone is that like it's so old and it's so unfunny and it's so from like a different time that hopefully people would be like, okay, people used to say that, like
people used to keel over laughing at that,
about that kind of thing.
I think you kept it in because it allowed you to use the trombone sound clip.
Oh yeah. Well, I actually know what happened there was I was really debating keeping it in or not, because mm-hmm. I was like, ugh, I just don't even like having this in the content of our podcast, sorry. Like historically. And then, but then I found the set trombone sound effect and I was like, oh, maybe this makes it work. Like maybe commenting on how bad it is makes it work. I don't know. I guess we'll find out if we get a bunch of feedback from listeners about it.
I'm sorry I put you through that.
That's okay. What else were you going to do? You can't make jokes on your own. It's hard to make jokes on your own. Anyone who thinks that stand-up comedy is easy, making jokes on your own is not, mm-hmm. not easy. Mm-hmm. It really helps to have people laugh at the dumb things that you say to make them sound funny.
We should move on, though. Because Shale, did you know that this is the last recording that will be released before Christmas?
I did know that, but only because you told me.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty crazy to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though I know that Christmas is really not that far away, it feels still to me like it's far away.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's going to start to get holiday busy here right away in the next like week or so. And I'm a little bit terrified, honestly. I haven't really thought about it enough this year. And there's always a bunch of things that I have to do around the holidays that, like for instance, I don't have any plan for Christmas dinner. I might need you to, help me plan out my Christmas dinner.
Oh, I've got an interesting, idea for your Christmas dinner.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. How about you make turkey and mashed potatoes and stuffing and,
Alan,
we're actually not going to do turkey this year.
We are going to do turkey this year. What are you going to do?
We're doing chicken, which everyone just says is a poor man's turkey. But the truth is just, we've got chickens that my parents-in-law raised in our freezer, and we're just going to roast the whole chicken, and that's going to be it.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, I do like turkey, and it is obviously different, but yeah, a roast chicken is amazing. And when do you ever like roast a whole chicken for your dinner? Like probably less often than you roast a whole turkey, I would bet.
We don't. Yeah. Like we eat chicken. We have whole chickens in our home regularly. We almost never roast them whole.
Roast them whole. Yeah.
Cause you got to make like, all the
cut
soup
them up and use them.
Got to make all the chicken noodle soup for Cora.
I hear you. Yeah. So it'll feel special. I feel like,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah. That's awesome. And then are you going to complement it with like a bunch of traditional, like, are you going to roast it in the like French style and then complement it with a bunch of traditional French accompaniments to a roast chicken?
What are the traditional French accompaniments to a roast chicken?
Great question. I don't exactly know. Let's think. I feel like some kind of glazed root vegetables would be a thing, like glazed carrots or something like that. Tournade.
Okay, yeah. I'll flute some mushrooms, yep.
Yeah, and flute some mushrooms, yeah. What else? It's got to be, I don't know, maybe potatoes isn't really, that's maybe more of a North American accompaniment or something.
I think there will need to be mashed potatoes.
Yeah. So it's going to be more like a Christmas dinner than it is going to be like a French dinner.
I think so, yeah.
Just with chicken substituted for turkey. Mm-hmm. That sounds nice. Are you going to brine your chicken?
I think realistically, I'm going to thaw it a few days in advance, rub it down with salt, and just turn the hood fans on. Sorry, rub it down with salt like a day or two in advance, leave it uncovered in the fridge to dry out.
Yeah.
Turn the hood fans on and just roast it at 500 degrees and try and get the skin crisp and
cool. So kind of a dry brine
situation.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of like dry brines popping up online lately. I think it got recommended by like a couple of blogs or something like that. And then I've seen like a bunch of like TikToks or YouTube videos where people are like just so confused by like the fact that they're brining something, but they're not actually putting it into a liquid and they don't know why it's a brine and they don't know what a brine is. And they're like, is the brine the liquid that comes out of the thing when you're brining it with dry salt? I don't understand.
Well, it's kind of, maybe I don't fully understand it, but it's a kind of confusing nomenclature, isn't it? Like,
I agree. Yeah. I feel like it's weird to call it a dry brine.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, I think it's dumb. I think it's a dumb word or phrase, term, whatever.
Yeah, but I feel like it's also...
You're just salting it. Like, you're seasoning it. You're putting salt on it. You're not dry brining it. You're seasoning it.
Yeah, you're curing it, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Or yeah, like depending on how much salt you use or whatever. Yeah, maybe you're just seasoning it or maybe you're somewhat curing it or something like that. But yeah, you're definitely not really dry brining it. Like, it doesn't seem like a thing to me. Brine seems like a liquid to me.
I think I would say that it is. That's part of the definition of the word. But I think it's just a silly evolution of language that's happened in popular food culture over the last 20 years where like, brining poultry was like this huge, like, it's going to revolutionize the way you cook at home. You're going to have the most tender, most moist, juiciest chicken. And then everyone was brining everything all the time. And now it's like
it's so hip to brine.
Everything has to be called a brine
in order for people to recognize it as a technique that they might want.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
Use or something like
that. You brine your chicken. Well, check this out. Dry brine. and then you get more followers, and it's so silly. But it's literally just salting.
You might be right, but there's a part of me that thinks that maybe that's like that I've read that terminology or that nomenclature used in like industry manuals about curing meat.
Oh, really?
So maybe. I don't know. I had just like have this rough recollection of like having been exposed to it before when reading about curing meat and stuff like that. And so I don't want to necessarily hang my hat on the idea that it's just like a modern portmanteau or something. Mm-hmm. But
oh yeah, you should look into that, because like definitely in the kinds of books like the Rallman and Polson charcuterie book, they definitely don't use that that term.
No, but oh yeah, actually, probably they probably do use the term dry cure though.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe I'm thinking of dry cure, not dry brine. And yeah, anyway, seen a lot of confusion about it online.
Yeah,
if you're like putting your meat in a container with like a huge amount of salt, let's call that curing.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely having a turkey. And it's probably going to be mostly a traditional holiday dinner. Turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, like you said. We usually have some kind of yam thing.
Yep.
Sometimes we have, I don't know, last year we did some kind of fun stuff. My brother and I made a bunch of pate. That was awesome. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if somebody else has some like exciting ideas for stuff that we can do this year. I'm kind of feeling like, oh my God, I'm not going to have time to do anything. But
yeah.
But I'm sure, like, you know, in the week before, I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, excited to cook some fun stuff for the holiday dinner. Mm-hmm. So
cool.
See how it goes. And Alan, you've been working on something special for the holidays behind the scenes. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Are you talking about the blind tasting? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's what this episode is actually about.
We actually sort of have a topic.
And usually we say the topic at the beginning of the episode after the intro, but we didn't this time.
Yeah, this time we kept you in suspense, dear listener.
Here's what we're going to talk about. Yesterday, I brought Shale two jars with liquid inside. One was labeled jar A and one was labeled jar B. Oh, I should have called it thing one and thing two.
Yeah, whoops.
And I asked him to take them home and taste them and write some ideas and notes and compare and contrast the two liquids. I think he found out very rapidly that they were two samples of two different eggnogs.
Right.
Was that apparent to you?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So nog A and nog B.
Right.
And I wanted to get his take and then talk more eggnog.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so do you want me to just give you my feedback about them now? I tried to write a lot of notes, but I didn't get very far, honestly.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of hoping that once we started talking about it, I would feel like I needed to quantify my feelings about them a little bit better. But I also have the jars here, so I can do a little bit of extra tasting if...
It's 10:30 in the morning.
If you have additional questions about the feedback that I sort of provided for myself, then I can, and if I need to taste them in order to figure out how I feel about a certain line of questioning, then we can do that.
Okay.
So jar A. Oh yeah. See, like there's lots of notes that I could have made here that I just didn't really bother to make because they seemed so obvious in the moment. And now I'm like, why didn't I write that down? Jar A. Upon immediate inspection, definitely has a slightly more yellow color to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me to be a little bit creamier in consistency, just like visually. And it really smelled like, I don't know, I want to say whiskey, but... Mm-hmm. It was kind of hard for me to like put my finger on exactly what it smelled like, maybe a little bit rum like, but like it definitely had, I feel like a little bit of oakiness or something in the flavor of the alcohol. And so, yeah, that reminded me of whiskey for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And then tasting it, definitely jar A was like pretty boozy tasting, like pretty alcohol forward, but not in a like, oh, I wouldn't want to drink this because it tastes too boozy kind of way, but just like in a you know, like a really well balanced way.
Mm-hmm.
And then also on tasting it, I was wondering if maybe there was something like sherry in it or something like that, because it had definitely had like kind of a nutty flavor to it, that I really enjoyed. And it felt very creamy to me and like really satisfying in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, probably if you were going to serve this like at home to people, you might shake it or something ahead of time to lighten it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe like a little bit rich, but not overly so, even though I didn't shake it or anything like that. I just drank it straight out of a glass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it definitely tasted like round and rich, but not off-puttingly so, mm-hmm. I would say. I'm just going to take a little sip here so that I can remind myself of what I'm actually talking about and see whether I agree with myself from last night. Oh, yeah. And something that I didn't write down, but that I think is important to mention, is that it's fairly sweet, but not like overpoweringly or cloyingly sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Just like sweet enough for it to taste like nog. So that was jar number one. That was jar A.
Jar A, yep.
Jar B. On opening it, it definitely has a slightly less yellow color.
Mm-hmm.
It almost has a slightly kind of like, I don't know what you would call it. It's definitely not like reddish or pinkish, but like more kind of, I don't know, has like more of a brownish or like kind of like pale sandy tint than like a yellow color.
To me, like I said, it looks a bit like malted milk, or like it almost looks like Bailey's, like the like whiskey cream.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like a light tan kind of color to it or something like that. And then you can see like, you know, like the difference between the look of like whole milk or 2% milk versus the look of skim milk.
Yes.
It has like this kind of like skim milkish kind of translucency to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exactly know where that's coming from. And then it definitely smelled a lot less. I smelled alcohol in it a lot less
mm-hmm.
the first time that I smelled it. It definitely had sort of like a toned down kind of like aroma to it. And then in the flavor, I felt like the flavor was maybe like definitely less alcohol forward, definitely a little more difficult, I think, to determine what type of alcohol is used in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has a very kind of like round flavor profile, but a little less kind of like dynamic, I think, than jar A.
Mm-hmm.
Like in terms of like the different types of things that I'm tasting, like maybe the flavor is like a little more cohesive in jar B, just tastes kind of like one thing
mm-hmm.
or something. Whereas in jar A, I can like taste more sort of like different flavors that are kind of playing off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe like not quite as dynamic in flavor or something like that. And yeah, then like I felt too like the texture kind of was, and I don't know if this was just bias from looking at it and having it kind of look like it looked like skim milk kind of, but it seemed to me that like texturally it wasn't quite as rich
mm-hmm.
as jar A. Yeah, so those are my major comments.
Yeah,
the yellow color is toned down, the booziness is like toned down. Maybe it tasted a little more cohesive and that it wasn't maybe quite as creamy in texture.
Cool. Okay. So if you had to, which one did you prefer? And if you had to try to speculate about what's different about them, what would you say?
Mm-hmm. I think I prefer jar A.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you had to speculate how they're different?
If I had to speculate, and this is like as much based on my my knowledge of you as it is on my impressions of the eggnog in the two jars. But if I had to guess, I would say that this is an aging test.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So a big callback to last year. Yeah.
Right. And additionally, I'll put myself out there and say that I think that B is the one that is aged more and A is the one that is aged less.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes, it is. So these are actually, the A and B are the exact same recipe,
right,
using the exact same spirits, like to the brand,
mm-hmm,
in the same quantities. Jar A was made yesterday and mm-hmm, jar B was made 1 year ago.
Wow. Yeah, it's such a huge difference. Like, it's shockingly different, which I think and the other reason why I guess that it was an age test is because I have done some aging of eggnog on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases as well, I think generally my preference wound up being fresh rather than aged.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is exactly, because people rave about aging their eggnog and definitely, like, on the scale of like a week or something like that, I think that, you know, like, the flavor does improve,
mm-hmm,
but like on the scale of like a month or more than a month, I feel like to me, the flavors just get kind of muted and aren't quite as like exciting or something, you know?
So it's interesting to me that you said that they are shockingly different, but in your descriptions, mm-hmm, of them, like, they weren't actually, like, my big takeaway from this is I didn't think that the one-year-old eggnog was necessarily superior or even that, like, you're right, it is different. I think, mm-hmm, you're right that a lot of the kind of edge of the liquor is a lot more mellow. Like, you get a little bit of like alcohol heat on the freshly made one, and much less so on B, or the older one. And yes, the colors are different. That appearance of the, like, the fresh one is like opaque. It looks like thick cream. And the, mm-hmm, the aged one, I actually agreed with you 100%, where I wasn't sure, or I had the same experience as you 100%, where I looked at it and it looked more milky and watery. But when I tried to be analytical,
objective about
it, about
the texture,
I couldn't really tell in my mouth, on my palate, like, if they had different body and mouthfeel. And in terms of I was surprised how subtle the difference in aroma and taste was. They're definitely different, but it was, I had it in my head that the 1 year one would be like, oh, funky, like, cultured dairy vibes, but like, no, not really. It's just,
no, no, it doesn't taste like cultured dairy. Like, to me, the main flavor difference is that, like, I'm not really tasting, like, is there sherry in it?
Yeah. And so the other big food court callback is that this is, the alcohol content in this is equal parts añejo tequila and amontillado sherry.
Okay. Like, I was wondering.
The Jeffrey Morgenthaler.
When I tasted A, I was like, whoa, this tastes very similar to the Morgenthaler eggnog that I've been making.
Right. Yeah.
And I wondered if it was the same recipe, because it was like shockingly similar. So.
It's not actually his recipe, but it is. His recipe is almost equal parts tequila and sherry. And this is equal parts tequila and sherry, but the other quantities aren't his recipe, though.
Right. Yeah, and the fact that it's añejo tequila is what's giving it that oakiness.
Yeah, totally.
Definitely. I would say that, like, in B, like in the aged one,
mm-hmm,
the sherry is much less, like, the flavor of the sherry is much less noticeable.
Yeah.
Like, there's much less of a sort of, like, I mean, there is a bit of nuttiness there still, but it's kind of much less pronounced.
Yes,
or something.
Agree.
Like, it's much less identifiable, I feel like.
Mm.
And that's because, I don't know, I guess it's volatiles leaving, but it's also probably, you know, it sits together so long that the flavors start to overlap each other or something. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. You could definitely see, like, or imagine aromatics being driven off in the aging of eggnog. It's like it was in a mason jar in the door of my fridge for a year, so it got sloshed around.
Well, I'm also a little bit curious about what volatiles might have made their way into it as well.
Oh, no.
But
The interesting piece here, there was kind of like an aged eggnog rabbit hole you can go down on the internet, on food, like big food blogs, like Serious Eats and Michael Rollman and stuff like that. Lots of people have written about it.
Yeah.
And they always, like, the first thing they always need to address is it safe? Because that's the first thing a lot of people ask.
Right.
And so they take pains to try and, you know, assuage people's fears. And I think the number that gets bandied around a lot is that 20% of the mixture needs to be spirit. Like, sorry, 20% right. of the volume of the total batch needs to be spirit. It's a little bit in Kenji's article on Serious Eats. It's especially confusing because at one point he says 20% of it needs to be alcohol. But if you read his recipe, it doesn't need to be 20% alcohol by volume. 20% right. of the total liquid ingredients needs to be spirit, like 40% spirit.
Right. Like a high alcohol volume spirit
yeah.
of some kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was curious about the, like in my personal recipe that's posted on buttonsoup.ca, how that compared to the 20% spirit marker. So Kenji's, right. and I compared it to a few other ones, a few popular ones online. So Kenji's recipe comes in just over 20%. Michael Rollman's recipe, which is specifically for aging it, comes in at frankly, insane 40%.
Oh my God.
Which means it's almost one-to-one.
What kind of spirit is he using?
I believe he uses rum and cognac and
one other.
It's principally
absinthe.
It's principally that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
His is principally bourbon with a little bit of cognac and rum.
No surprise there, yeah. I guess.
That's almost 1-to-1 hard alcohol to egg and cream, which is I've made that recipe and it's too boozy.
Extremely boozy, yeah.
The button soup, the Alan Suddaby one, comes in at 15%.
And
that's interesting to me because I have aged it for a year and it's under that 20% that everyone talks about, but I have drank it often and no issues.
Doesn't taste like it has any off flavors or any like kind of weird like dairy flavors or anything that seems like, and I mean like, I don't exactly know what percentage of alcohol you need to have like pretty much microbially sterile mixture. Mm-hmm. Whatever I'm going to say, take with a grain of salt. But it feels like, you know, if you're at 20% and you're using spirits that have like 40% alcohol,
yeah.
Then it's 8. Then what are you at 8, actually?
8% alcohol 8%? By volume.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, like beer sometimes comes in at like 4, mm-hmm. you know, and I feel like, and 5 is very common for beer. And that's a type of alcohol that you can and is like sterile.
Right.
And so, it doesn't surprise me that something slightly lower would be perfectly safe. Mm-hmm.
Especially in the fridge, like, something that's 8% alcohol in the fridge. Like if you have an open bottle of wine in the fridge for a year, it's not going to mold. Like it's...
No. Yeah. You may not want to drink it after that.
Well, you can cook with it. and the Jeffrey Morgenthaler recipe, because half of its alcohol is sherry, which is usually more like 20% than 40%, it's actually more like 11% spirit. In the final formula, although his isn't explicitly for aging. It's more like it's a mixed drink for a cocktail bar kind of, but.
And if I'm being perfectly honest, Alan, when I make it, it may be slightly more than that, but yeah.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily follow it slavishly.
I see. Yeah.
And I have reduced actually the main alteration that I make to that Morgenthaler recipe when I make it is I'm usually reducing the sugar content by half. I feel like there's too much sugar in the recipe. It's like too sweet if you add all of the sugar that he has in the recipe. And I usually reduce the sugar. And the larger the batch I make, I don't always reduce it by half. If I'm making a small batch, I'll just reduce it by maybe 25% or something like that. But if I'm making a large batch, for some reason, it seems like even though I'm weighing the sugar, it seems like the larger batch I make, the sweeter it tastes. Oh, and really? So mm-hmm. when I make larger batches, I tend to reduce the sugar even more, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. up to 50%. So
that's another piece that's not addressed in the food safety concerns is like, yeah, okay, alcohol content, I get it, but it's in the
fridge.
But
it also has a ton of sugar.
Yeah,
in it.
Loads of sugar.
Yeah, I mean, seems perfectly safe to me. And it's also like, it's dairy and eggs. If something bad did happen in there, it would be so obvious
right.
that you just wouldn't, you know yeah. like it would smell horrible and then it just would not be palatable and you wouldn't want to drink it unless, I don't know, it was all you had to get through the winter. And right. it was all that was left in your stores because you had a really hard harvest mm-hmm. and all you had left was eggnog from the previous year. You might be compelled to drink it if it tasted a little bit too funky or something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
But if I opened my jar of eggnog and it smelled like rotten eggs or rotten milk, I would throw it in the garbage.
I quickly looked to see if there was any articles on like the science of what's actually happening when you age eggnog, because especially that, like mm-hmm. your observation that you're going from opaque, creamy look to a more watery, milky look. Is it like
yeah.
fat is being broken down into amino acids or something and becoming?
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah. That's yeah. Hmm. You said you did look for some information about that?
I did a quick online. Sorry, fat is not composed of amino acids. I just said a stupid
no.
science thing. Fatty acids.
Proteins are,
yeah, exactly.
are made up of amino acids.
Yeah.
But I wonder if it's like, yeah, like that could still be a thing. Like if the proteins are being broken down or something, mm-hmm. or if the proteins are being denatured into amino acids mm-hmm. by the alcohol or something, then maybe they don't hold on to the fat.
Yeah.
As well, or something like that. Maybe the emulsion just gets different because there isn't as much protein mm-hmm. to keep the emulsion stable or something like that. I'm not quite sure.
It seems like the kind of thing that there will never be a scientific paper on, because who would pay for that paper? Like hipster bartenders? Like who's going to pay for that?
Somebody. Yes, exactly. At some point, there's going to be like someone who really wants to be the Harold McGee of like mixology
right.
or something.
Yeah.
And they're going to want to get a degree and have their PhD be about alcohol denaturing flavor volatiles or something like that.
Isn't the Harold McGee of mixology David Arnold?
Yeah. I mean, you could say that.
But he's not actually a scientist,
you know,
mean, or?
David Arnold isn't actually a scientist. Not that I don't think he's very smart, and not that I don't think that he has a pretty scientific approach. Mm-hmm. And I definitely, you know, would take whatever he has to say about alcoholic beverages with, you know, like with deserved reverence. But yeah, he hasn't really written a reference book
right.
about it.
Okay.
You know, yeah. Anyway, I would drink B, but yeah, I would take A over B just about every time, I feel like. And that's interesting for me too, because I've been trying to like do this thing where I save part of my eggnog and age it. And then I have never really been satisfied with like, and I've only ever aged it. I've never, I think, aged it for longer than like 2 months or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I've never really been satisfied with the flavor of the one that I'm making. Like after I've aged it, I'm just like, this just doesn't quite taste as like fresh
yeah.
or something to me, which makes sense. But, you know, at the same time, I just, and then I was kind of like, you know, everyone's crazy about aging their eggnog. Maybe I'm just not doing it right.
Right.
Or maybe
yeah.
I'm just not appreciating it the way that it needs to be appreciated. But yeah, I think
that's the
after
away.
Doing this blind taste test, it's been a little bit illuminating for me, because I feel like I've determined that I just prefer
yeah.
the unaged stuff.
I think, yeah, me too, honestly. I think that using really high quality spirits helps a lot. Like, because
right.
if you have fresh eggnog and it's made with Captain Morgan's, it's a lot different than fresh eggnog that's made with Cazadores, Añejo tequila, and Barbadillo
yeah.
Amontillado sherry. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so much complexity
built into it.
Well,
and obviously there's a huge range of things that you can do there to like make the, you know, to bring deliciousness to your eggnog. I mean, like, yeah, I think like the starting point for most people is buy carton eggnog from the store and add spiced rum to it.
Right.
And, you know, like that's sort of like the starting point. And I feel like it can only really go up from there. Mm-hmm. And then once you start, you know, like considering making your own base for it and considering what types of spirits you might want to add to it, then you can really tailor it to your own kind of palette. Mm. Or you might have one that somebody else made and be like, oh my God, this is amazing, which is what happened to me with the Morgenthaler recipe.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, got me excited to make my own eggnog.
Yeah.
But I am not excited to track down all of the sherry that I'll need. That always winds up being a problem.
Because you need so much, or because it's not, Amontillado is not commonly in.
Yeah, it's like places carry it, but they carry like one or two bottles. Mm. And every time I've gone looking, and like in previous years, I've made like relatively large batches so that I could give it as a gift to people.
Right. Yeah.
At work or whatever. And yeah, just like for making a large batch, I've always had trouble tracking down enough sherry. So I don't know.
Well,
hopefully this year,
the Garneau Sobeys Liquor has a row of Amontillado sherry right now. If you want to go.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. I'm going to be on White Ave today. I'm going.
Yeah.
Oh, should I also be considering going to what's the pancake?
Oh,
place
Fua
called?
Fua.
Fua Fua.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where I should be trying to get some lunch or something if it's open.
You bring me one? Just kidding.
I might, honestly. I'll drive by and see what the situation is.
Okay.
If there's like a lineup or something, then I probably won't have time to do that. But if it looks like I can get in and get pancakes, I would bring you one.
That's our show. Just
kidding. Got anything else, Alan? Or did you make a big batch of these of this eggnog, or did you just like make the jar A in a small amount just so that we could do this taste test and you're actually saving your eggnog making for closer to the actual holiday weekend? Or
just shy of 2 quarts.
Oh,
so
cool.
That'll get me through the week. Just kidding.
Right on. And do you give eggnog out as gifts, or is it mostly just for you and Lisa to drink?
It's mostly for me, and usually, like historically, when we've had guests, when we've entertained at Christmas, we'll offer eggnog to people. But I've never given it in jars as gifts.
Gotcha.
It's a good idea, though.
That's just a Shale thing, because he doesn't ever know what to get anyone as a gift.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.